The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 869. It's the 11th of September 2017. On the podcast today, I have Arthur Mulholland, President and CEO of Canadian Overseas Petroleum, COPL ticker, and Arthur answers private investor questions. Also on the podcast, CEO John Kennedy and Managing Director Mark Slade of Proxarma, PROX, and the guys discuss today's launch of their new customer-facing business named Location Sciences. Also, Richard Morrell, soon to be Group Chief Technology Officer and Managing Director of Phalanx Cyber Technologies, talks about what attracted him to working at Phalanx. And of course, Phalanx ticker is FLX, and then does cybersecurity, very hot area at the moment. Plus, Malky, Oil and Gas Sector Authority, talks about the following companies: Jersey Oil and Gas, JOG, Providence Resources, PVR, STX Energy, STX, Rockhopper Exploration, RKH, Premier Oil, PMO, and Empyrean Energy, that's EME. As always, I have the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs. In fact, it's not five today, it is 6-7, because there's a joint fourth position. Exciting, eh? But you can't wait.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Arthur Mulholland, President and CEO of Canadian Overseas Petroleum, at COPL ticker. Arthur, thank you for joining me.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
Yeah, we got some questions from private investors, and you're a very well-followed company, and so we got some questions submitted. We'll get to that in a bit. But before we do that, for people new to investing or not aware of what you do, Arthur, could you give a brief summary as to what Canadian Overseas Petroleum is all about, please?
Yeah, we're focused on West Africa and primarily right now offshore Nigeria. And our focus, I should also add, is on oil and gas exploration right through to production opportunities offshore rather than onshore. Our project in Nigeria is 30 miles offshore, the central part of the Nigerian delta, which is most people know is one of the world's premier petroleum provinces. And we have a very attractive oil appraisal and development project with we have 50-50 with a Nigerian partner called Shoreline. Mm-hmm. So later this year or early next, our intention is to drill an appraisal well to an oil discovery that was made in 2001 that we feel all feel is quite large. And that is to drill that well and actually put it on production. Mm-hmm. Because we have a Nigerian interest, our company has an interest in the license, is that we are, or they are, with Nigerian content, allowed to enter into what the government, the regulator, calls an early production scheme. Mm-hmm. And what that allows us to do is take the cash flow that the project throws off and reinvest, continue to reinvest it, which would much turn into a much larger development. So what we're the attractive part of what we're doing here right now is to finance this first production well, if you want to call it that, because that's what it is. And we're well along in that. And so the company's going to be actually quite active here in the next little while once we start this off.
Excellent stuff. Okay, well, with that in mind, the first question is sort of in two parts, but it says, how much money is in the pot and what is the cash burn? How much is required for drilling the appraisal well?
Yeah. We have, and I don't know the exact number because I'm not the accountant, And we released our financial results were released for the second quarter a month ago, and so in there I would ask any investor, if they continue to have this question on their mind, please do go on our website, www.canoverseas.com, and in there you'll see our quarterly reports, and you can go back and length of time, and you can find out and calculate our monthly cash burn yourself. It doesn't change. And the reason why I'm saying this, because this is a question I get a lot, and sometimes I get tired of answering it because it's very easy for people to find. Yeah. But it's about $400,000 U.S. dollars a month. We report in U.S. dollars rather than Canadian dollars or sterling. And we have around about $3 million, or maybe a little north of $3 million U.S. dollars on hand. So one can look at that and say that, you know, we're not in dire need to raise capital, for example, to fund our overheads or whatever.
Yeah. Okay. And the next question is the funding still scheduled to be completed by the end of September? Also, when should we get ministerial approval?
Yeah. So in there, you got what I left out, and I'll answer it in the next question, is what does it cost to drill this well? And our engineering team has been working hard on the costs, and the well plan itself is getting more detailed as time goes on. Mm-hmm. So right now we're the number that we're facing in front of us now is approximately $19 million U.S. dollars, and to drill and complete the well up to the point of turning it into a production well. Now, that number has got a fair amount of contingency based into it, and we expect those costs as we get closer to commencement of operations to come down. Followed into that is, how is the process with the financing going? On August the 12th, we put a press release out and said it was going very well, and it is still going very well. We have solid interest from one of the world's major crude oil trading organizations, as well as a merchant bank, and those discussions are very far advanced, and we expect it may not be by the end of September. Things take longer than you think to happen, but they will. We expect they will happen, and they're very positive. They're not negative, and so. There's another organization that we're talking to that, again, is and these would be financings that would not be dilutive to shareholders. They would be more of a debt, on a debt basis. Mm-hmm. Our target is the end of the month to hopefully have an announcement out. As you know, Europeans went on holidays, go on holidays for most of the summer, or at least for the month of August. So that kind of slowed us all up, but it's moving along, and it's quite positive. I just want to encourage people to say, just because there's no news, it doesn't necessarily mean there's bad news. It just means things sometimes take a little longer than we thought.
Yeah. I mean, do you know what? You're right there. Generally in life, things always take longer than you think, doesn't it? You know? But you plan for something, it normally takes a bit longer. Yeah. But there we go.
Yeah, it's easy for people to say no.
Yeah.
But when people say, hey, we're interested, then there's a period of time where, the relationship or the terms of the relationship need to be discussed. Mm. And those terms, take time to put together.
Yeah. Okay. Next question is, will the funding be dilutive to current shareholders?
I think I answered that already. Our plan is to do it, you know, either on a debt basis or on a basis where some of these groups may be interested in a interest in maybe the financial interest in the asset. Now, you know, everything in life when you finance something is dilutive somehow, whether it's dilutive on a per share basis or it's dilutive you may have to give up a financial interest in the asset itself. So, but our current plans, and I say that our current plans don't envisage that that it would be on a directly to the shareholders, but mm-hmm. just to do it without issuing equity.
Yeah. Okay. Next question: has a drill rig been acquired, and when do you intend to start drilling in Nigeria?
Yeah, we've identified a rig that we find suitable, or in fact, we've identified a few. Right now, in the process is that I can answer your question is somewhat yes and somewhat no. There are lots of rigs available right now, and it's a buyer's market rather than a seller's market. The costs have come way down on a day rate basis. And because that our intention is that the plan is to utilize the jackup rig after we drill the well for a production unit. So in other words, we're in 150 feet of water. We would take most of the drilling equipment that's on board and on the deck off the jackup rig. And we would put a separator package, which is just separates gas and water from oil, on the deck, and then essentially that's the basic processing of the oil that you do before you sell it, and it would then flow into a storage tanker. Now we're also in discussions and looking at if the processing unit is on the tanker, then we don't need it on the deck of the drilling rig, and we may not need need one that's a certain specification. So we do have one or others identified for a target date to commence operations, and right now we don't see much difficulty in picking and choosing at the time. So our plans are not essentially a single rig specific. There's lots of rigs available.
Yeah. Okay. No worries.
That really answers the question, but it should say that yes, we've identified. Mm-hmm. And that the rigs that we identified are available on our time scale.
So, yeah. Excellent. Okay, next question is, how does Nigeria differ to the Liberia exploration project?
Well, Liberia was frankly a true and pure exploration well. The closest well that had been drilled you know, sort of, if you want to call it near the location or close from the location that we drilled, was 30 miles away, and in a basin that had yet to find any commercial accumulations of petroleum, even though that there were some indications and very strong indications on seismic data that what we were doing was indicating that there was a substantial amount of hydrocarbons there. The difference being is that in where we are in Nigeria is that the basin in Nigeria is one of the world's premier petroleum provinces. And I mean premier. The issue in Nigeria issues in Nigeria historically have not been the ability for people to find oil, but generally in the case of the onshore areas is the politics of working there. So what we have in Nigeria is more appraisal to development in nature. So we have a block called OPL-226 that we own with Shoreline, our 50-50 partner. We own 80% of. And it is quite a large block. And on the block were five wells historically have been drilled. Mm-hmm. Three of those wells intersected oil and gas, and two just found gas in another part of the block. But the three wells that intersected oil and gas essentially are on the flanks of a very large structure that was discovered to be hydrocarbon-bearing in 1972 by a company called Texaco, where they drilled right at the top, at the crest. And they found a section which is primarily gas. The wells on the block that we have, and it's in a separate block that's called an OML, Oil Mining License 83, that just covers this gas area. Well, we have everything that surrounds it. And the three wells that were drilled on the flanks of the structure, two on the north, or excuse me, the west flank, and or the north flank, and one on the east flank, all found oil. And so the concept is that if you've ever made salad dressing, which a lot of people have, if you mix oil and vinegar together, the oil comes up and sits up at the top because it's less dense than the salad oil does the vinegar. Well, the same is true what we're doing. So natural gas, which is methane, rises to the top of a structure because it's the lightest component. Crude oil sits in the middle, and then water. Mm-hmm. So we know where the water is. And essentially, to make it simple, is that on this structure is what we're drilling is the well that we're offsetting was drilled in 2001, and when oil was $19 a barrel, I should add. And found what we would call the oil-water contact. So what we're doing is just moving up from that, between it and we'll call the gas. And so it's very much a development project rather than an exploration project. And the water depth is 150 feet versus 8,000 feet that we drilled at in Liberia. So and it's easy. Now, this project sat there dormant from 2002 to present day, just primarily because the block, the group that had it in 2001 when oil was $19 a barrel, they didn't think too much of it. The economics were didn't fit right for them at that period of time, and so it was a Nigerian group. They turned it back to the government, or they chose not to renew the license. And it sat there, and then it was issued to a group out of India in 2008. They were committed to drill a shoot a 3D seismic survey and drill another well. So we purchased with Shoreline 80% of ESAR Nigeria, because ESAR got themselves into some financial difficulties, and here we are here today. So it really is like rewinding the clock, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. All right, and the final one, Arthur, is what are your long-term plans for Nigeria?
Well, our long-term plans is to, develop this block, and we see there's other structures on this block that are untested or semi-tested, let's put it that way, that are, we'll call more exploration in nature. So the plan is to take this area here, get it on production, and we believe we can do that, as well as look at the other opportunities, which we believe could turn it into our net interest in it would be much larger than would be if we had discovered oil in Liberia with ExxonMobil. That's what the appeal is here, at a much lower risk level.
Yeah.
As well as that is because we have a very good relationship with the Shoreline Group. There's other business to be done in Nigeria, you know, over time. And we feel we can turn Canadian Overseas into a very large organization, again, with a very good background or footprint in Nigeria itself.
Yeah. So, excellent stuff. Okay, I thought, well, thanks. That's all the questions. And one final thing, if someone's listening right now, like the sound of this project and where it's going, but are not yet following you on Vox Markets, could you give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button, please?
Well, I think what we offer is a very seasoned technical team that's very difficult to find these days. We also are working in one of the world's great petroleum basins. It's Nigeria, but most importantly is we're doing it with a very well respected local partner who participates with us right beside us. So in other words, it's not that we have to carry them or anything else, that we're true partners. Mm. And that makes an awful lot of difference. And it should people give the confidence to know that we're not going to get ourselves involved with anything in the country that one of the locals wouldn't get involved in themselves. So I think that's really important. And what we're looking at is big. So yeah. should give us all, and I'm a shareholder, a pretty good ride as time goes on. Okay.
Excellent. Arthur, good to chat to you. And like I said, you've got a busy few months ahead of you, so hopefully we'll chat again in not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Look forward to it.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Kennedy, CEO, and Mark Slade, Managing Director of Proxarma. Ticker there is PROX. Guys, thanks for joining me.
Hi there, Justin.
Hi, Justin.
Now, you've had some news out today. It's the launch of Location Sciences. We'll get to that in a bit. But before we do that, John, for people not aware of Proxarma, could you give a brief summary as to what the business is all about, please?
Yes, Proxarma is a company that is steeped in mobile technology. We have two divisions. Our primary division is a mobile location intelligence company, Location Sciences. And we have another division called Proxarma Digital Payments. And both those divisions run side by side.
Excellent. Okay, so the news out of the day is concerning the launch of Location Sciences, and Mark is going to be the managing director of that section there. So, Mark, take us through it. What's it all about, please?
So, Location Sciences, what is Location Sciences? We enable brands to effectively bridge the gap between the digital and the physical world. So we use precise mobile location data to inform businesses and marketeers on how effective their products and services are for advertising.
Okay.
So we allow them to understand the physical movements of their customers in the real world.
Yeah. And so what's behind the name change here? Why a name change?
Well, we wanted to get a name that would reflect the sort of essence of the business. Proxarma doesn't necessarily mean anything in terms of mobile data, so we wanted something that really resonated with our customers. So the location piece is the fact that we are deriving GPS location and beacon location data. And the science piece really is the clever stuff. That's where we use our proprietary tech. We use machine learning and data science to really get that value and that insight out of the vast data sets that we're collecting.
Yeah, so how does it do this? Take us through, exactly how it works. So you're using what, GPS and the beacons, and what's the kind of market? How many people will you be tracking? Give us a bit of detail on this, if you could, Mark.
Yeah, so put simply, we do commercial deals with application owners to embed our technology into their application. That allows us to get precise location data from their customers. And with that location data, we apply that data science piece in order to create the value and give insights to marketeers So that's the kind of essence of how the business works for us, and then we sell that data to the marketeers and sell those insights.
Yeah, and at the moment, for people not aware of you, so you have beacons, don't you, across different parts of the country. Where are they at the moment, predominantly? Are they across the entire country or are you up to certain cities?
Yeah, we have beacons across the entire country. We combine that with GPS data, which gives us a bit more scale. Beacon gives us that granular detail, and we use different location technologies where applicable.
Okay, and this tracks, so I don't know if you can give an example here, this tracks of people's movements around the areas and what they're looking at. So how would that be, can you give it as a real life example, how would it be useful to a company, this kind of data?
So we can use this location data to create audiences for advertisers. So if British Airways wanted to target customers that regularly travel abroad, we could identify customers and users that go to airports a lot. We can allow advertisers to see the effectiveness of their digital advertising by tracking the amount of customers that see adverts that go into store. That allows them to sort of attribute value to real world activity in combination with the value they get from their digital spend. Another product that we are working closely with our partners with is on the out-of-home industry, and that's really allowing the out-of-home industry to understand more about who views their out-of-home adverts, providing audience insights into those customers.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, data is power, isn't it? When you have that kind of information and you can tell what a customer's doing or the potential. I mean, is there any figures out there as to the potential? Because it seems like a hot sector to me, this kind of data tracking. I mean, is there any figures out there to suggest the potential of this market?
Well, it's actually a pretty big market already in terms of digital advertising. So about 45% of all mobile advertising spend, which is a nearly £4 billion market, has an element of location in its targeting. So it's already there. What we plan to do is provide more insight and more granularity into that location data than the market can offer at the minute, taking it up a notch.
Marvellous. OK, well, if someone's listening to this right now and likes the sound of this new tech and, you know, this sort of data that you can glean from consumers, but they're not yet following you on Vox Markets, maybe, John, could you give us three reasons why someone should hit that follow button on your page, please?
Yeah, I'll give you a couple, and I'll let Mark wrap up. Mm-hmm. Firstly, I think as a business, we continue to execute on the strategy we promised, which is that we would be fit for growth. So we are now debt free, we are now fully funded, and we're extremely cost efficient now as a business. I think secondly, I've installed a strong management team across not just the data sector but also the technology sector, and have location sciences well positioned in a really hot sector. And thirdly, Mark?
I think the real value in this business is in the data that we collect and the way that we analyze that data and provide insights. If you believe there's value in this data and there's value in collecting, you know, millions and millions of data points on millions of consumers, then it's worth investing in.
Excellent, guys. John, Mark, thanks for coming on, and hopefully we'll chat again soon.
Lovely. Thanks, Justin.
Thank you. Cheers, Justin. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Richard Morrell, who will become soon Group Chief Technology Officer and Managing Director of Phalanx Cyber Technologies. Richard, thanks for joining me.
Good morning. Thanks very much for having me on the show.
Now, I'm sure people are aware of Phalanx. We've had several people on from Phalanx before, but just to put people in the picture there, it's a global intelligence, security and cyber defense provider. So, Richard, first and foremost, you will be joining soon with those titles. So let's get a bit of a backstory on you. I'm sure people in the industry know you very well, but for people not in the industry or haven't heard of you, tell us about yourself, please.
So I've been around security and open source for almost 20 years now. I'm one of the veterans of the Linux and open source community, self-starter working with Red Hat since they were founded back in 1997. In fact, I came back to Red Hat in 2009, 2010, and had a seven-year stint, which finished in December when I started my own company, AuditSec, which has been providing security technology consulting at the highest level through Gartner, where I'm currently CTO of the Global Security and Risk Practice. But along the way, having been heading up security at Virgin Media, heading up consultancy for Logica, who are now CGI, and working with GCHQ and intelligence agencies in the US and also across Europe. I'm also on the board of the Cloud Security Alliance, where I'm CISO for the Cloud Security Alliance in EMEA. I spent a lot of time keynoting. I was on stage last week at Trend Micro's major event in London. I do a lot of after-dinner speaking around security to a lot of global major brands. And I have a podcast that's been running since 2012 with about 140, 150 odd episodes and over 3 million downloads and listens, talking to everyone from the White House to major CISOs of global companies.
So it's fair to say you're quite a respected member of the cybersecurity.
I don't know about respected.
You know your stuff, though.
It's the fact that I've dared to be different. In 2000, I created or co-created a technology called Smoothwall, which is the internet content filtering and protection system that protects every single school in the UK, all the local authorities in the UK, major brands such as Halfords, Moto service stations, school districts across the US, Ford. So, you know, my claim to fame is that there are currently about 290 million devices out there on the planet, which I wrote the technology behind, which protect people on a daily basis. And a lot of people in the security industry who I lock horns with every day found their first groundings in Smoothwall, and it's a known brand. And, you know, it's been that thing where I'm still known as the, you know, the Smoothwall guy, which is bizarre because I've written a lot of other technologies that are available on Android handsets and, you know, a lot of shipping routers. If you've got a BT Home Hub or a Netgear router, the chances are a lot of the technology you're consuming and using there, I wrote and invented.
Wow. Okay. So just to explain, Phalanx have acquired your company, AuditSec, and so you come with that and all your experience.
I do.
Yeah. Okay. So currently, though, you're CTO of security at Gartner.
I am.
So why, you know, what are your drivers for you joining Phalanx?
I met up with Jay Abbott, who is the managing director of the cyber division at Phalanx in February. And he stood me at a whiteboard and explained how the technology that he was building, a technology called Midgard, built entirely out of open source components. Now, the thing is, I come from an open source background, as I had already said, and he knew damn well that that was akin to opening up a box of Thornton's chocolates in front of me that I wouldn't be able to resist, being able to see what was about to come out of his pen on this whiteboard. And he drew for me a construct of his concept of how you would take a company on a transitional journey that would allow them to have the same level of autonomous protection enjoyed currently by major FTSE and GM 100 companies who normally pay millions of pounds or millions of dollars a year for that level of monitoring and event capability, the ability to do remediation on the fly, the ability to understand what's going on actually across your network and to be able to react to it now, not do the post-mortem and triage that we see in the press on a daily basis, that we're now seeing with Equifax, that we're seeing with TalkTalk, etc., etc., where they're trying to find out what happened, to allow companies to understand what is happening. Because here's the thing, many of the organizations that I work with on a daily basis have spent tens of millions of pounds building organizations and building sales front ends. They're now extending into the cloud. They're using mobile technology. And the problem they've got is that you can very, very, very quickly lose everything with regards to a breach. If your platform is breached, customers lose both confidence and respect in your brand, and they walk. You get churn. So you spend all that money, and all of a sudden, your brand is damaged because somebody didn't tie down Apache Struts, or somebody left a PHP script open, or there was a cross-site scripting attack, or a man-in-the-middle attack on an SSL certificate. You want to be able to understand what's happening now. You want to be able to understand what's hot on your platform, but you also need to be able to understand what incidents actually look like and what they mean to you, what their currency is to you as an organization, so that you can take those reactive stance steps. Now, currently to do that in the proprietary world, if I'm if I'm a major chemist chain and I go to a system integrator, they'll build me a platform. They'll build me a platform out of Splunk. They might bring Vector in for some threat intelligence. They might have a proprietary database. They've got a huge amount of storage there, and they put this in their data center, and they charge me £3 to 5 million a year as a big organization to host this for me, this architecture for me. Small to medium enterprises don't have that sort of money. What Jay has done is build a technology around open source components using the same open source components that power the likes of LinkedIn, that power the likes of Twitter, using Hadoop, using Rancher, using open source components that are extremely quick, extremely fast, to build out a service offering. That, do you know, Doc, the problem I've got is that it's not, you can't align it to something else in the marketplace because it's a service, it's not a product. What essentially you've got, what essentially you're doing is you're piping all that event data into the security operations center back at Phalanx HQ, which provides you the ability to actually, you know, go to bed at night and understand that your network's in safe hands. But more importantly, if there is an issue, for you to be able to picture what that issue is and to be able to allocate resources around it to be able to deal with it, rather than that issue own you and also own potentially your reputation.
Yeah, wow, okay. Well, listen, I mean, you know, we all know, and it's been in the press lots of times over the last few months, you know, it's a hot sector, cybersecurity, but it's also quite crowded by security players.
It's a very crowded sector.
Crowded. Is there room there for disruption, you think?
Massive. I mean, I spend time at major international security shows. I'm the official show podcast for the RSA conference at the Moscone Center in San Francisco every year. So, you know, that's the biggest security conference on the planet, and you walk around Moscone south, east and west, and there are maybe 850 vendors there, and probably 75% of the cost of the show is sponsorship from these hardware vendors and technology vendors. What Phalanx does is so dynamically different and disruptive that it carves its own niche. It doesn't actually play alongside the Splunks and the Elastics, because that technology is built into the back-end platform. The customer doesn't see anything other than capability, other than peace of mind, other than that integrated monitoring. And to do that, as I said, you need to have a blended stack. Now, if you were to go to an RSA or to go to an InfoSec show, you would have to talk to 3 or 4 vendors and then go away and build that platform yourself. And the problem you have doing that, which hits you straight in the face, is things like version control. You've got to make sure the platform that you build is built of a technology that's still going to be there in 18 months, 2 years' time, if that vendor's acquired or goes through IPO, et cetera, et cetera. So what you're doing with Phalanx is you're buying into a proposition, you're buying into a service. And for me, there's a huge, powerful rationale around that, because it stands head and shoulders above what other organizations are doing, which are trying to solve piecemeal issues like GDPR or like vulnerability management or threat intelligence or penetration testing, whatever. Phalanx doesn't get involved in that. All it's doing is essentially is being your sleeping policeman, effectively looking after your brand, looking after your assets, looking after your data in play. And especially with some organizations who now have moved out of that traditional network architecture and have moved into cloud, they've taken those tentative steps into cloud, where essentially there's this gap between what they own behind their network firewall and then potentially the security or maybe the higher security grade offerings available from their Amazon Web Services partnership or their Microsoft Azure or with Rackspace. And traditionally now we're seeing organizations where we talked about the promise at Gartner of things like cloud access service providers or CASBs. We talked about hybrid cloud. Organizations really aren't into that. The hybrid cloud model has changed. They're not building a cloud out of what they've already got. They're essentially building out to cloud. They're consuming catalog service items from cloud providers. Now, every time you bolt in an authentication module, or you're building into a directory service or a storage platform, or talking about using containers or Docker or Kubernetes and doing all that cool automation, you're increasing your risk appetite as an organization. And sometimes what happens we see is that the ambition of companies to move faster than they should is ever present. Sometimes as security people, although we don't want to be the guys to say no, sometimes we have to be the guy to curtail the ambition of the organization to say, look, we can do this, but we need to put this sensible rationale around it. Well, in comes Phalanx with Midgard, because what Midgard does is essentially allows you to monitor everything that you can see and all the ever-present machine data and the event data that's coming out of all of the hosts that it can access. So essentially it's going away and being this massive indigestion tablet for the CISO or for the person in that organization who is responsible for reporting to the board. And also, you know, when there's an outage or if there's an outage, trying to paint the best picture from a PR perspective to keep that company's reputation together. So crowded marketplace, disruptive technology. And disruptive technology always gets on people's radars because essentially what it does is it provides a safety blanket and a level of comfort that many organizations would love to have. And when I sat down with Jay, I got back in the car and drove the 200 miles back home. And I was buzzing. I got in, my wife said, well, you know, why are you so excited? And I said, because I don't think he understands what he's got. genuinely, this is that good. And I have striven since I sold Smoothwall to find someone who was capable of generating that level of disruptive technology, which I could take to the next level. Because I'm not just excited about this, you know, potentially there's a larger play around things like the Internet of Things, where you have major organizations who are pushing hundreds of thousands of devices into specific generic vertical platforms. And all those devices, whether they're IP4 or IP version 6, are going to have things like message broker stacks and QQT talking to them, enabling them to be able to service and harvest information from a node, such as a smart meter or a sensor within a hydroelectric plant or wherever this is, or a train, back to a data center, not just to work out is the device still there, but also to get that data into their platform so they can understand as much as possible about the customer. But in those sort of platforms, you have things like potential theft of service, you have KPIs you need to monitor and do uptime. And I've been working with major service providers at Red Hat and also at Gartner, who are in the IoT space, who would absolutely kill to not have to spend $16 or $18 million over the next 5 years building out that architecture, building out that response platform. And Midgard slots into that from a data collection and enrichment process that, from an IoT perspective, these are just devices. These are widgets on your wider area network which need to be managed. I mean, if you're a Scottish Southern Power and you've got 235,000 smart meters, do you want to be sending a service engineer at £48 a shot to go and try and fix these devices out in the field? No, you don't. You really don't. There's a massive, massive hit on your bottom line. If you have got a Midgard platform, you have got the potential to be able to have that hierarchical monitoring and event service management, which protects both your profitability, but also your reputation. And I think that's what's disruptive. This is reputational protection. This isn't just security protection. When we go to security shows, people are selling you assurance and they're selling you the ability to integrate their TIN into their platform in order to provide a service. Mm-hmm. Phalanx aren't doing that. Phalanx are saying, stay safe. You know, we have the people in our security operations center. We have the technology on an automated basis in order to try and protect you at a higher level than you've ever had before without you having to try and hire people to do it. And that's one of the major problems that companies I work with. I was out in Spain 2 weeks ago in a major organization up there, and they have a problem with retention of people. Good security people tend to not last very long. They tend to go to companies who can pay them more money. And what we find in the security industry now is that, you know, good security people tend to not just get higher salaries, but also want to work where they're challenged. So retention of those staff is difficult. At Phalanx, one of the things that got me was the fact that I walked into a company where there were people who were not just what I would call ethical hackers, but were innovative, who were actively involved in the wider community, who were out there doing the UK Cyber Challenge, who were involved with projects across Ministry of Defence, across GCHQ, in the intelligence services. So they have that higher level of grounding. And I'm also a GCHQ certified class consultant. I work with the intelligence services. So for me, it was almost, you know, like meeting the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. One final question for you, Richard. Many companies now are looking to move parts of their business to the cloud. How does Phalanx deal with this ambition for these companies?
One of the issues we have as organizations is that back in the day, 15, 20 years ago, developers in the hierarchical food chain of organizations were people in the back room who built stuff on Lotus Notes and Microsoft Access. We threw them recommendations and requests, and they built us a database or they built us a widget. Developers now in the food chain of organizations have moved in the hierarchy. We are trying to build out to cloud faster and quicker than we've ever done before. If we look at things like AWS reInvent that they do every single year, you know, there's probably 30 or 40 new catalog service items that are released just purely by Amazon. Cloud service providers are trying to offer more capability than ever before. So the ability to provision faster, the ability to do tear up, tear down, the ability to do security event management, the ability to do access controls, et cetera, et cetera. All of that stuff is there. However, what companies are finding now is that it's not just one cloud. Many companies are provisioning to multiple clouds, which means multiple security governances, which means that you as an organization need to understand what your responsibilities and what your regulatory environments are. But more importantly than that, you need to understand how to communicate. And I stand on stage and I give a talk on a regular basis about how security people are really, really bad at talking about cloud to developers. And I talked about how developers have moved in the hierarchical food chain. Now, if you talk to many organizations such as, I don't know, there's a major food retailer in the UK. I was doing some work with a few weeks ago where they have 740 people in their IT department, 740 people. And out of that 740, 430 of them are developers. There's about 116, 117 in network ops, and there's 3 in security. So those 3 people in security have got to embed themselves across those 480 developers to be able to be involved in every single stage of application development, application provisioning, test lifecycle, and moving those applications out into the cloud, and then managing them once they're in the cloud with all the requirements that they have. And one of the things that security does very, very badly is essentially embed themselves within other teams and organizations. We don't understand continuous integration, continuous development environments. We're fighting to stand still. If you were to talk to the average security professional in the UK who's got his CISP and said, talk to me about the requirements of RubyGems, or talk to me about the requirements of Python, how do I provision this application in OpenShift or Cloud Foundry? How do I do that securely? They will not be able to give you the answer. I almost guarantee it. They will not be able to give you the answer. They're looking to you as the developer to essentially say, are you using the latest, greatest? Well, that doesn't stack anymore. We need to be doing the job better. And Phalanx, by having the ability to listen, enforce, and to be able to report, gives organizations that little bit extra comfort in the respect that their security guys, who may not know all the answers and who can't keep up with development technologies and processes, at least are bolstered by the fact that there is this get out of jail, which is doing that monitoring and doing that escalation for them. And that's hugely powerful, hugely powerful.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, Richard, you're a big fan of the sounds of it and very enthused by this new appointment. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens. But listen, if anyone listening right now likes this enthusiasm, but are not following Phalanx on the Vox Markets page there, give them 3 reasons in bullet points why they should hit that follow button on Phalanx's page, please.
Security is going sky high. It's the biggest growth market out there. You just have to pick up the press to see 2 or 3 security stories on a daily basis where organizations are relying on third-party companies to keep them safe. Phalanx has a story to tell, and Phalanx very much is part and parcel of the security ecosystem as it grows. Secondly, as we talk about what we mean by assurance, organizations cannot hire people quick enough. They cannot hire people with the skill sets they need to keep up to date with emerging technologies, both in mobile and in cloud. Phalanx gives people the ability to get out of jail and to stay out of there and to protect their reputations. Thirdly, Internet of Things. Internet of Things is here. I've been working on provisioned embedded devices for 15, 20 years, but I've never seen growth like this. I work with major organizations across the globe on development of devices. We're talking about an autonomous ability to be able to push these devices out there in the field and then be able to manage them. Currently, as it stands, there is a gap in the marketplace for the ability to offer that security management technology. And there are very few global players, very few, you can count them on one hand, who have the level of capability to do that at the device and at the network level. And Phalanx is one of them. So if you're not watching, you should be.
Excellent stuff, Richard. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll chat again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on the show.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Oil and Gas Sector Authority. It's Malky. You're right, fella.
Yeah, I'm very well, Justin. And you?
Yes, I'm good. I just tweeted out a little tweet saying, we must remember when you're investing in exploration, you know, the chances are similar to backing a non-favourite horse, pretty much, aren't they, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you're doing a wildcat well in the North Sea or Porcupine Basin or anywhere around the world, really, they used to say that, you know, you had a 10 to 20% chance, maybe, you know, one in five would be fair enough. And you have to bear that in mind. You know, some of these are mitigated by, you know, the seismic is much better than it used to be and that sort of stuff. But even so, you know, this morning tells us that that's the way it goes. That's the excitement and the risk of investing in the sector. And it makes you think that you should, you know, a bit like my bucket list, to make sure you have a portfolio of things. Try not to keep all your eggs in the one basket and have a portfolio of things, because, you know, the stocks I'm going to mention today, you know, two of them have got dusters, but three of them are doing quite well. So, you know, you must never get two down or two up.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's get the bad news out of the way first. So, I mean, obviously we're referencing Providence and Jersey Oil and Gas, haven't we?
Yeah, I mean, Jersey Oil and Gas, their Verbier prospect, which was being drilled by Statoil. You don't get much better than Statoil, and my people at Statoil said it was up with the best of their prospects. But it encountered water-bearing upper Jurassic sands, so nothing doing there. They've said that they might do a sidetrack, I think, you know, like jog. I think that's extremely unlikely. Source rock is there, but you know, we'd all look back to the Talisman well from 2005 and hope that they might the oil might have been there, but it wasn't. But you know, the good news in a way, there's no real good news for this, except of course Jersey were carried for this. There was no cost to them. They're still in business. They've still got a great team there. They've got cash in the bank of $2.5 million quid. They're still planning their original strategy. I mean, they've only been set up for a year or two, so you know, they've done pretty well so far. But you know, they're still planning to buy. You know, the strategy is to buy growth through potential asset acquisitions and production. I've already spoken to CEO Andrew Bennett this morning. He tells me his team is at Jersey is still solidly looking at a number of prospects. In fact, the number of prospects that they could buy has picked up in the last few months. So I wouldn't be surprised to see something in there. As I said, you know, it's a dry hole. It's a rank wildcat in the North Sea. It had a higher chance of success than most because of that previous well. But and you can see what's happened to the share price. It's probably been a little overdone, I'd have thought. But there you go.
Yeah, well, it's bouncing. I mean, it was down about 83-85% at one point. Now it's 76% down. Still a massive markdown, but and I've seen some people trade it already and make a profit from that. So
yeah, I mean, to bear in mind that they've got a really good team there across the board. They've still got the money. They've got good sources of funding when they do these production deals. And if they do a production deal and come back, you know, they've still got acreage which might have some decent exploration prospects on it. So you must never overdo it on the sell side, like you must never overdo it on the upside when you don't know what the result is.
Yeah, and down as well, about 28%. As we speak, is Providence Resources. I mean, they've been down previously because they had Drombeg and Druid as well, so not so bad hit in one day, but overall it's probably as bad. What's your take there, Maggie?
Yes, it probably has. I mean, they'd already had a hit because of Druid. Now, Drombeg is also water wet, ironically. Oil charged but not retained, as they say. It's only the second well in the Porcupine Basin, and this is massive frontier exploration. If you look at, you know, anywhere around the world over the last 100 years and more, is that, you know, basins aren't often found with the first or second well, and quite often not even until the 15th or 20th well. So it's very much early days here. Obviously a big disappointment, because it looked like on the on the seismic, if as it was there, but you know, it was water wet and oil charged, so you know that's why to a certain extent people got overexcited. Again, minimal cost to them. I, to be honest, I think they might even come out a bit ahead financially. They've done some pretty smart deals in terms of carries. They've got obviously Cairn and Total, and you know they will be, you know, extremely disappointed, but you know, they've got a decent portfolio of acreage in the area. The CNOOC are drilling a well on Diablo next year, which will be a sort of mirror image. As I say, they've got more stuff in the portfolio, and I understand that they're planning to drill an appraisal well on Barry Row. You have to have a very long memory to remember how long it goes back that Barry Row is being farmed out, but if they can get to grips with that, that'll be a step in the right direction. Yeah, very disappointing, Justin, but you know, onwards and upwards, I guess.
Yeah, well, like you said, both companies there, I mean, you know, especially, you know, PBR, like you said, lots of other, prospective assets there, but, and also a good deal done, so it's not going to hit them financially. So, So, you know, valued at that, I mean, it's hard to value, of course, because a lot of them are just exploration, but a massive amount of licenses, haven't they? So, anyway, what's the good news then, Marky?
Right, well, the good news is that we spoke last week about SDX. And you know that I'm very keen on SDX, and they snuck up during the week last week with a small raise, $10 million raise, which I wasn't really expecting, because they always need money because they've got an exciting exploration prospects coming up. But that was done at the price, no discount. The close of play the previous night, massively oversubscribed, according to my spies, who tell me that. Everyone wanted to have a bit more action here. There are some big institutional players in this stock, and this raise gave them the firepower to just carry on. They've already got quite a big drilling program in Egypt and in Morocco, but this will mean that they'll be able to carry on with South Dussuk in Egypt, which is their big gas discovery. They've got at least two more wells there. They will actually have a little look to see if there's anything in the oil front there. I'm not expecting it to be necessarily, but if it was, it would be a huge bonus. But the point is, they'll be able to bring that gas on stream quite quickly. And I think it could be, I mentioned this in the blog, it could be twice as much. It could be 100 MMCF rather than the 50 they've got in the book. And so, you know, it could be a lot more gas from Egypt, where they are getting paid, and of course at least two extra wells in Morocco, where they've got a significant exploration plans there, and I would expect them to be drilling, you know, since they bought the Circle stuff, they've been working hard on a number of prospects, and I think they've come up with, you know, two or three which really demand being drilled straight away. The good news for these ones, of course, is that, you know, wells here are about £2.5 million, which gets the, you know, right away from mobilization to actually having the gas when you find it, and there's a high prospect of finding gas actually piped into your customer's pipe, and so, you know, they could be in the money getting these things back. And with nine rather than seven wells drilling, one of the big costs of the drilling campaign is when you, you know, the small number of wells, where your mobilization costs are now being divided by nine, not seven. So that's very good. As I say, the low cost and coming on the stream. So I'm expecting SGX to be revenue plus by next summer, and they proved themselves to be doing extremely well in Egypt and in Morocco. They've made a super acquisition. Paul Welsh is an extremely competent CEO, and he's got a very good team around him. They'll be probably doing more deals at some stage. Financial backing, which means that you know, I don't think they actually were specifically looking for a raise, but I think their big backers said, you know, we're happy to put more money in. Makes it very high quality investment in the sector here, Justin.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent stuff. And what's next, Malky?
Talk a quick word about Rockhopper, because although they had results last week, their results weren't what I was looking for particularly. But what I really did like the look of was that they, and to a certain extent Premier as well, but I mentioned them last week. But it looks like the Sea Lion financing, which is Sea Lion is the the Falklands play, as you know, the financing is beginning to, you know, look like it might be getting together. They're in discussions with UK Export Finance, where there might be a large ticket of a loan there, and of course that would be at a very reasonable rate. They've got the proposed senior debt at some stage, and of course they're talking about funding from potential contractors, and that's happening more and more nowadays. We've seen it in a number of places. The contractors are, you know, in order to maintain position on the gig, are prepared to finance it. They're in what they call non-binding discussions on that front at the moment. But the phase, and of course, Sea Lion is going to be developed in phases, which makes it easier to swallow if the first check isn't an absolute monster. Phase one costs have already come down from $2.8 billion to $2.5 billion. Life of field costs have come down to $35 a barrel, which is great. Rockhopper have got a strong balance sheet. They've got $62.5 million in the balance sheet there. Huge carry from Premier when it decides to go. And, of course, although Premier have had to look at their other things, in particular the refinancing that they've been doing over the last year or so, right now, with the discovery in Mexico, Tolmount going very well and being financed by infrastructure, you know, Sea Lion is going to be 20% of Premier's portfolio in the early 20s. So, you know, it's in their interest for it to go ahead, and it looks like it's beginning to happen. So it's been a real slow burner, Rockhopper, but maybe things are about to happen here.
Excellent stuff. And you said you had three good stories there. Go for it.
Yeah, you know I'm going to talk about Empyrean Energy.
Yeah.
You take a quick look at that share price now.
It's flying, I know. I've seen it be mentioned
about
a lot.
It for about 6 weeks. I was, thank goodness, I took a call from Tom Kelly, the CEO, who I knew very well from when he was doing it before, when this whole process started up. And he told me it was very exciting. Now, this thing is just getting more and more exciting every day. So although I mentioned it last week, I'm going to mention it again because they've had more good news from Dempsey, which is the onshore gas well that they're drilling in California. But they're on the way to the TD, the target depth, which is, and they've already had what they call significant high level of gas shows all the way down. And if they're still finding significant gas shows as we nearly get to TD, this could be very significant indeed. I mean, the plans, you know, the target was at 1 TCF, which is 300 BCF net to Empyrean. Mm-hmm. You know, all eyes on the wireline logs now, because if they come in and just show that it's very big, I mean, it could be more than that. And, you know, for a company as small as Empyrean and doing such exciting stuff, this could be an absolute monster for them. And, of course, just for good measure, they announced last week that they've only got three assets. The other one is in China, and they've identified 591 million barrels of potential over three prospects in Jade, Topaz and Pearl. And most exciting. Now, I've got a meeting with Tom Kelly tomorrow. He's over from Australia. You mustn't rule out the fact that I'll talk to you about it again next week. But those people who've backed this one have done very well. There's no reason why it shouldn't go a lot higher if this one comes in.
Yeah, well, I'm just looking at the share price here, and literally, when you started talking about them, they're, you know, sub 10 pence. I mean, they're now now 24 pence, and last few days have been stratospheric. You know, they're just rocketing up there. And like I said, if there's more positive to come, you think, well, it could go higher, or is it all baked in? I mean, because, you know, a lot of, when it's with shares, you know, as you know, a lot of the time it rises on the hope of something bigger. But when the actual news lands, you know, then it settles down a bit, and you think, so you know, if it is decent, I mean, I would say never buy a spike, but I mean, if it is decent, and like all share prices come down and consolidate, then is the time to start doing some research now, and then if you still feel there's an excellent asset there, then is the time to pick some up. But I wouldn't be tempted to these levels. But remember the last time I said that to you was on Echo Energy IRG. But that one, it was up like 200%. I said I wouldn't be buying here, and it ended up sort of 800%, something ridiculous. So I was wrong there. I'm probably wrong again, but who knows.
It looks very exciting anyway.
Marvellous. Marky, thanks for that, and we'll speak next week, fella.
Yeah, thank you very much, Justin.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at 5, Angus Energy, ANGS. At 4, always there, Ascent Resources, AST ticker there. At 3, I wrote a blog about them on the weekend, Hurricane Energy, HUR. At 2, Imperial Energy, EME. And number 1, most followed company on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours is Jersey Oil and Gas, and Malky covered those, and Imperium, and of course they had a bit of a duster today, so they fell massively, and I think people were looking for a trade opportunity there in JOG. I always have a problem with J, even though it's the start of my name. Anyway, here we go, top 5 most liked RNSs, and there's 3 or 4 at a joint 4th position. At 4th position, it's Zenith Energy. Zenith issues equity to fund workover rig purchase. Also at 4, Seeing Machines. C is ticker. Final results. At 4, Mayen Energy. MYN. Operations update. Also at 4, Phalanx Group. Of course, I had Richard on earlier. Acquisition and appointment of CTO. At 3, Ortac Resources. OTC. Corporate update. At number 2, Silver Falcon. Sylph. Wow, it's been a while coming. Proposed acquisition and placing and subscription. And number 1 most liked RNS on Vox Markets platform this morning was from Talao Energy, TLOU. Final results. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.